Coming up on Under the Dome, lawmakers scramble to deal with sexual harassment issues at the Capitol, the governor gets overridden more than ever, and money starts flowing for some of the state's unpaid bills. Hello, and welcome to Under the Dome, the State Journal Register's podcast about Illinois politics and happenings at the state capitol. I'm Angie Muse, the executive editor, and today I'm here with Doug Finke from the State House Bureau. Busy week, Doug?
To say the least, it's the wrap-up week for the veto session, and that always does tend to be busy, but of course the legislature brought some additional work on themselves with trying to address the sexual harassment issue that's been roiling around state government and the Capitol for the last couple of weeks in particular.
I was going to say the wheels of government sometimes turn slowly, but not on this one.
They can move quickly when they want to, and in this case they wanted to, and it actually started last Saturday when, after 3 years, they appointed a legislative inspector general, the Legislative Ethics Commission, which appoints or approves the appointment. Met or had a conference call on a Saturday, no less, and approved a new legislative inspector general who was a former federal prosecutor in Chicago. So her task, it's a temporary appointment, and her task is going to be to sort through the 27 complaints that have been filed. Well, there was no inspector general, to see if any of them merit further investigation or if they are unfounded. But that was followed by the legislature this week. On Tuesday, both chambers approved several bills meant to address the issue. One was a rather sweeping bill that requires lobbyists and all levels of government, including local government, to establish policies to deal with sexual harassment. It provides for training for lawmakers and staffers and lobbyists in what constitutes sexual harassment and how to avoid that. It also sets up a specific complaint process in the state, anyway, if people experience sexual harassment, how they can file a complaint, and establishes fines of up to $5,000 if someone is found to have committed those acts. Another bill that they passed lifts the statute of limitations on investigating cases, because the old state law said that a complaint had to be investigated within 1 year after it was filed. Obviously, without an inspector general, those complaints could not be investigated, so the time was running out on several of them. So they passed a bill quickly to eliminate the statute of limitation so those cases can be investigated. And both chambers, both the House and Senate, also set up task forces that are going to meet for the next year to further investigate this and see if additional legislative action is needed.
Right. And we should note that we don't know the specifics of these 27-ish cases that are pending, because, you know, some of them may not involve sexual harassment. You know, we just know that there are cases.
Right, and we don't even know for sure if they involve legislators.
Because they could be staff members
exactly,
as well, correct?
Right, so any kind of ethical complaint involving the legislature goes to this inspector general, but it doesn't mean, again, that it involves a lawmaker.
Right. The only complaint that at this point is public, because people have talked about it, is the one involving Senator Ira Silverstein, because his accuser, a lobbyist, made this comment, you know, talked about it publicly at a committee hearing. And then, of course, earlier in the week, Senator Silverstein acknowledged it as well and said he would be talking to the inspector general.
Right. He was actually present on Tuesday when the Senate voted on all these bills. He voted in favor of them. And when the Senate ended its business for the day, Silverstein walked over to the area in the chamber where the press is assigned seating and just said, basically, I'd like to talk about this, but my statement is going to be to the inspector general, and then walked away and didn't answer any other questions.
Yeah. And then you mentioned, Jill, this will require training for legislators, and that actually began this week as well?
Correct. The House was in session on Wednesday, and they broke in the afternoon for over an hour, and the Republicans and Democrats both went to separate areas and took training on the issue, and then went back on the floor and resumed business. The Senate on Thursday, as we're recording this, is getting their training in it.
Mm-hmm. And what have you heard about, you know, the gist of the training?
I haven't heard a whole lot of details. I mean, it's there are a lot of private sector employers, including the newspaper, require employees to undergo this kind of training on sexual harassment issues, racial sensitivity, all sorts of issues like that. And you know, the training is somewhat similar. You know, they present instances to people, you know, of certain behaviors, and then present the questions, you know, is this appropriate or not? And then there's a discussion about why it is or is not appropriate. So.
Yeah. Okay. Well, besides doing all of that, they also had a lot of action on vetoes and veto overrides. You know, the governor again saw several bills that he had vetoed get overridden.
Yeah, they overrode the governor on more bills this year than I think in the first 2 years of his administration combined. I think it's significant. Some people are reading into that there's this a sort of revolt going on against the governor, and there may be some element of truth to that, but the fact is there was one bill that the governor absolutely wanted to see his veto sustained on, and that was a bill that would outlaw local governments, local units of government, from creating right-to-work zones. That bill was muscled through the legislature largely on Democratic votes. The governor vetoed that, and the Senate overrode the veto, but the House did not. It sustained the veto, so that bill has died. That was arguably the one thing the governor wanted to win on, and he did in this case.
And this was the second try at overriding him in the House, and it also failed.
Right. And coincidentally, it was by a single vote. 2 weeks ago, they tried it, and it got 70 votes on the override. It needed 71. This week, it was the exact same vote count, 70 votes, just one short. And even before the vote was taken, a Democratic lawmaker who supported the bill said he figured it was going to turn out to be 70 votes, just like it was 2 weeks ago, and he was absolutely dead on. I mean, they had obviously had this arranged that one way or another was going to fall just short of what it needed for the override.
Mm-hmm. And different people this time, or same?
There were some changes as far, you know, a couple votes here or there, but ultimately, I mean, it was the Republicans who I'm sure had it arranged that if it got to the 71, some of their people were going to start peeling off to make sure it did not pass.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then some of the votes that were overridden, the debt transparency that Susana Mendoza, the comptroller, had pushed for, the Senate, not surprisingly, easily overrode the governor on that. And that's the bill that requires agencies to start telling the state every month how much they have in unpaid bills.
Correct. And
how quickly does that take effect?
I knew you were going to ask that. And I'm not sure of the exact effective. The bill itself takes effect immediately. How soon it's going to be implemented, I cannot answer. The question is the administration decides to drag their feet on it. Mendoza was asked about that yesterday, and she had a news conference after the veto was overridden, and said that would have to be something to be addressed. I mean, there's certainly, I think, public pressure playing on this. People know that this information now has to be provided. The administration, I think, would appear to be non-transparent or blockading things if they tried to stall on it at this point. So I think the pressure is certainly going to be on them to comply with it.
Mm-hmm. And then the Treasurer Frerichs also had been backing a bill that also the governor vetoed, but yesterday the Senate went along with overriding, following in the House's footsteps.
That has to do with ensuring the life insurance companies pay out the claims that they are supposed to. There have been audits done that reveal that in many cases there are policies that have been taken out and premiums paid for years, but then when it comes time to pay them, the companies do not. And it's supposedly because people aren't aware that the policies even exist in some cases, and the insurance companies don't go out of their way to make sure that people know that they're entitled to money, and this bill is supposed to address that. And, you know, as long as we're talking about constitutional officers, Attorney General Lisa Madigan had her own bill that she was pushing this year about student loan bill of rights to give people with student loans some additional power or leverage in dealing with companies that do student loans. That was also overridden. So you had three statewide elected officials, all Democrats, whose bills were vetoed by the governor, and the legislature overrode the vetoes in all three cases.
Yeah. Now, the one, though, the bill issue that I have to say got the people on the State Journal Register's Facebook page debating back and forth was over cursive writing, whether school kids ought to be taught cursive writing.
Right. And this is the proponents of this bill make a couple of arguments on that. In this modern day and age, you know, kids grow up just communicating using keyboards.
Yes.
And they don't really learn the traditional cursive writing, even though a person's signature is required on things like voter registration and driver's licenses and marriage licenses and all sorts of things out there. And also not to mention that a lot of the documents, the founding fathers wrote in cursive, and the concern that can kids even read this stuff if it's not translated into just print. So it got a lot of attention, and both the House and Senate overrode the governor's veto of that. The governor said it was an unfunded mandate. The proponents of the bill said they didn't believe there was any cost involved, and if there was any, it was minimal. So I'm not sure if the kids are going to enjoy it, but it's on its way. The schools are going to have to teach cursive again.
Well, and as journalists, I think we're probably precluded from weighing in on the legibility of cursive handwriting.
Well,
most reporters I know,
we're
not exactly shining role models.
If my cursive writing is any indication, I'm not sure this is going to be a successful endeavor. But
okay. And then the other significant thing going on with state government this week didn't have to do with legislation. It's the bill backlog is up over $16 billion at last count, but this week there's some action to start whittling away at that.
Right. The General Assembly, when they did the budget deal back in July, authorized the state to borrow up to $6 billion, to pay down the bill backlog. And they issued the bonds a couple of weeks ago. The money is available, and Comptroller Mendoza said that as of Wednesday night, they were starting to pay down bills with the proceeds.
And who is she planning to prioritize, and why?
She is prioritizing medical-related bills for a couple of reasons. One, Medicaid bills that are stacked up qualify for federal matching funds. So when you pay those bills, you get additional federal aid, and that's one reason to get those things paid off, is because you can bring more money into the state with that. The other is state employee health insurance claims, which are subject to late payment fees. And so the idea is if you get pay those things off, at least they're not accumulating any more late payment fees.
Right, because they stack up interest as the time amount they sit unpaid.
Exactly. And there's also essentially a humanitarian reason for that. Is in a lot of cases, state employees found out that because these bills were not being paid, their doctors were saying, you got to pay up front for your medical treatment. And some people are able to do that, some people are not. And you wonder how many cases of maybe more expensive procedures people had that were postponed because they couldn't pay upfront fees.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and certainly here in Springfield, the economy has been affected by that with it being a regional medical center.
You see that not only with the medical community, but businesses in all areas say that the budget impasse and the impact it had on state employees has affected their businesses.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Actually, later, watch the SJR.com. Our health reporter, Dean Olson's doing a piece checking on how, you know, the health institutions have fared through all this. So a little plug for coming up. All right. So that pretty much covers, you know, everything that's been going on this week, I think, right? Or have I missed anything?
We hope so. And now it's going to be a kind of a lull period until they kind of crank up a little bit next spring. The House, incidentally, just
the House is adjourned until
the House is adjourned until January. The Senate will adjourn after today, presumably. The House came out with its calendar for the spring session yesterday, and so I think they're supposed to be in session all of 4 days in January and all of 4 days in March.
Okay, so, nothing in February.
Yeah, or the February is kind of a busy month.
Okay,
but it's
February,
just, it's
okay.
Sandwiched around 2 months where they're not going to be doing a whole lot.
Gotcha.
Here in Springfield. Anyway,
but I think the next key date coming up is early December, where we have the filing deadlines for the ballot.
Exactly. And then we'll find out in particular whether Representative Jeannie Ives has been able to gather all the signatures she needs to mount a challenge to Governor Bruce Rauner.
In the meantime, we had a blessedly off year for no election this year, although locally Bernie had to write about how the Sangamon clerks were getting calls about people wanting to know where they went to vote.
Well, it may be people were confused because there's been a never-ending stream of ads by
you
the gubernatorial candidates.
You could be forgiven for thinking we had an election going on.
Exactly.
Well, before we end, Doug, though, anyone who follows the press corps on social media, there may be a burning question they need to know. And the week's mystery was about the Girl Scout cookies and the recycling. I have to ask one burning question. Do Girl Scout expired cookies taste any good?
I tried one. It was tolerable. I guess I could make a plug that Girl Scout cookies hold up fairly well. So if somebody finds them in their home, a box at the back of the cupboard that they didn't know existed, go ahead and dig in.
In my house, there's never been Girl Scout cookies that didn't get eaten. But as a troop mom, I appreciate the plug. But anyway, that's the lighter note of Under the Dome, where we cover what's happening with Illinois politics and state government. Tune in next week. You can catch our podcast on Stitcher and iTunes. And as always, thank you for listening.